the key to the highway. Build out and bound to go. I'm gonna leave here running, just walking is much too slow.
Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, February 2nd, 2025, and this is Episode 6 of The Rift. By now, you've probably seen the images on the news or on social media. Skies turned dark orange by flames, houses and neighborhoods left burnt out and destroyed. Beginning on January 7th, high winds, severe drought, and a buildup of brush combined to spark a series of massively destructive wildfires across the Los Angeles metropolitan area. All told, as of this weekend, the fires have forced over 200,000 evacuations, destroyed or damaged more than 18,000 buildings, and killed at least 29 people. The scale of the burning also resulted in weeks of poor air quality. The most severe were the Eaton Fire in Altadena and the Palisades Fire in the Ritzy neighborhood of Pacific Palisades, respectively the second and third most destructive wildfires in California history. Wildfires in California tell a multitude of stories. The stories of people from all walks of life, from wealthy Hollywood celebrities in the Palisades to middle-class black families moving to Altadena to escape redlining, pushing the footprint of Los Angeles into areas that they didn't yet know were fire zones. The stories of indigenous tribes of Northern California making sophisticated use of cultural burning to manage landscapes for human use, and their subsequent repression and displacement by colonizers, resulting in a buildup of flammable brush in the forests of Northern California. The stories of California's incarcerated firefighters, prisoners working an immensely dangerous and vital job for the state for less than poverty wages. And increasingly, the story of climate change and its hotter temperatures and drier droughts that lead to more frequent and more severe wildfires. When we look at the history and causality behind California's wildfires, each of these stories and more intersect and collide with each other, forming a kaleidoscopic picture of a phenomenon that impacts thousands of lives each year. While I was watching the fires unfold from afar, I knew that I wanted to talk to someone who could help me understand them. Not necessarily from the perspective of a fire ecologist or a climate scientist or a historian, though of course those perspectives are certainly valuable. But for this week's show, I wanted to hear from someone who could speak to the lives of ordinary people affected by the fire, what it means for someone who deals with the day-to-day struggle of surviving and making a life in Los Angeles to have increasing climate-driven disasters dumped on top of it all. That's how I ended up speaking with Elba Serrano. Elba is the Associate Vice President at East Los Angeles Community Corporation, or ELAC, where since 2010, she has helped the organization construct affordable housing, provide services and assistance to residents, and engage in community organizing and advocacy. After the break, you'll hear my conversation with Elba about the work ELAC does in her neighborhood, how they've been responding to the fires, and what organizing and community building looks like in a world staring down the barrel of climate change. But first, programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at elliottcounselinggroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you, in part, by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products, as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500. And now, here's my conversation with Elba Serrano. I'm joined now by Elba Serrano, Associate Vice President at East Los Angeles Community Corporation. Elba, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
So just to start off, could you tell me a little bit about East LA Community Corporation and the kinds of work that you all do there?
Yeah, thank you. So at East LA Community Corporation, we just say ELAC for short. We're a community-based nonprofit organization. We were founded in 1995, and our mission is to advocate for social and economic justice on the east side of Los Angeles. And we do that in different ways. One of the ways that we do that is through community development. So we are a nonprofit developer, so we develop affordable housing. We have over 1,000 units of affordable housing all throughout the east side of LA, including Boyle Heights, East LA, Sereno, if you know LA, any of the nearby communities in the east side of LA. So normally east of downtown is where you think of the east side. We also oversee a lot of just community services and community engagement. So as part of a developer, we really want to make sure that the community has a say in what we do and what we bring to our community and that investment. So we do a lot of community engagement to get feedback from them. We have a lot of services as well. We do anything that has to do with financial services, so coaching, housing counseling, rental counseling, helping people with a free tax preparation program, and helping them understand finances. We do work with a large population of the immigrant community. So in Boyle Heights specifically, about 98% of the community here is Latino. Most of them are, immigrants. Many of them are children of immigrants. We do have a large population of monolingual Spanish-speaking immigrants. Many of them are undocumented. And just required a lot of support in understanding what it means to be in the U.S., right, financially, and just everything that comes with being an immigrant in this country, especially in L.A. So a lot of our services are catered towards supporting those individuals. So all of our team that works with community is bilingual. So we make sure that we meet clients where they're at, you know, understanding that they may need a little bit more guidance and understanding and education. And the last aspect of the work that we do is through advocacy. We are a community organization that is always going to be advocating for what the community, you know, wants and needs and listening to them. So we have been part of a lot of different coalitions. Currently, I'm part of the LA Street Vending Coalition. So I'm part of the steering committee. So as part of the steering committee, we have been able to legalize street vending in Los Angeles. And that happened in 2018. And the first permit started to be given out in 2020. And we, as part of the California Street Vending Coalition, we were able to legalize street vending actually statewide. So that actually was a huge win in 2018. And then most recently in 2022, we actually passed a new law, SB 972 in California, and that modernized the retail food code. So what that means is that vendors, street vendors that sell food, they were not considered in the California food code, and they are now. So now when a vendor wants to go get a health permit to vend food here in LA, like you see a lot, you see, you know, hot dog vendors, taco vendors, you see the fruit vendors, they are all able now to go to the Department of Health and get a permit, you know, if they have all the right cards. So part of what we do as also in the coalition is we provide a lot of education and help them understand how to get those permits and get, you know, legalize their business. So that's a little bit about ELAC and what we do here.
Wow, that is a really wide swath of work. That's really cool. I wanted to, of course, talk about the work that you've been doing in the wake of the wildfires in Los Angeles County. I think, you know, across the country, we've heard a lot about, you know, wealthy celebrities' houses burning down in the Palisades. But of course, the fires have had direct and indirect effects on so much of the Los Angeles area. What are the effects that you've been seeing in East LA, and how have you been working to respond?
Yeah, I think so when people have been hearing, you know, all over the country around the fires, they're thinking Palisades, right? They're not necessarily thinking about like how it is really affecting the rest of LA, specifically the people that work there, right? The workers, the day laborers, the gardeners, the nannies, the people that go in, domestic workers. So in a lot of what I've been hearing and when talking to people and all of our clients, you know, who are immigrants, many of them undocumented, they rely on just those type of jobs. You know, they get paid on the cash basis, they're self-employed. They're 1099, you know, they receive a 1099, they do their taxes. We have free tax prep, so we get to talk to them. And so they, you know, they are the ones that are actually, you know, at a loss because they don't have anywhere to really file for unemployment, right? They can't really go out and get support right now, especially because they just are not able to work. So those are one of the main things, you know, when you think about what's happening in Palisades, really like those people that we forget about, which are, you know, the actual workers. The other thing is that there was another fire, the Eaton fire, that was right in Altadena. So Altadena was one of the, it's actually the one of the only neighborhoods where a lot of Black and Brown people were able to afford many years ago homeownership. So that is actually has been a huge loss and probably the biggest loss for Black and Brown communities and losing their homes, because that's many times when, you know, people are here, they're immigrants and or you're barely starting out, like your home is your asset and you don't have really any other assets. So that is a huge loss. We recently just dropped off, one of my coworkers dropped off some supplies, and we gave them a call to see what they needed, because a lot of the people that are cleaning up after the fires in Altadena are undocumented labor workers, so day laborers. We called them and we asked them, what do you need? What supplies do you need? And they told us, we need toilet paper, paper towels. We need just regular supplies. And luckily, they we were able to get some of that. We got a fund. We have a couple gift cards. We were able to do that. And so we dropped them off this morning. And we are buying some more supplies that we can drop off next week. So hopefully that answers your question. But just, you know, just thinking about those labor workers and domestic workers and all those people that, people forget about.
Yeah, definitely. I'm curious, you know, talking to people who have been involved in organizing in Los Angeles specifically, and I think specifically in like Latino communities, you hear about this model of promotoras, who are essentially, you know, people who are in the community who are trained to become kind of bearers of information as part of these informal networks about things like, you know, immigration enforcement, ICE raids, or even public health. And I'm wondering if you see that as something that could be an element of disaster response. I'm curious just about how that model works and whether you think it might apply to rapid response scenarios like mobilizing people to protect each other during these disaster events.
Yeah, thank you for asking. It's a really successful model, promotoras. I definitely see them in different aspects and of the work that we do. You know, I was actually just talking to a promotora yesterday. So we have a rental assistance program where we're providing rental assistance to community members that are behind on their rent. Her job is just to spread the word. I grew up in Mexico. I'm an immigrant. I came through to the U.S. when I was really young. And I remember that the way my mom, when we moved to the U.S., the way my mom heard of what was happening was through neighbors. She obviously listened. She did watch the news. You know, there's a lot of news out there. But if she needed to know what was going on locally in the neighborhood, it was through their neighbors, other señoras, other ladies that were out there just being involved in the church or in different types of groups where that's where they were hearing about what was going on. So it's basically the same thing, you know, here and what we see in LA is the promotoras are out there, you know, they're on the streets, they're where people are at, right? They're at markets, supermarkets, they're at different at churches, just all of the different areas where they can encounter people. And then they just talk to them. And that's how they spread the news. A lot of the people that we work with are not necessarily as tech savvy. You know, during COVID, we saw, right, there was a huge digital divide and people not being able to access resources because they weren't tech savvy. So these promotores are the ones that are out there, you know, providing information and helping people. One of the things during COVID they were doing is they were actually helping people learn how to use Zoom, right? Or like helping them schedule appointments. So when thinking about the wildfires right now, there's just a lot of just people needing support and services and they don't know where to go again. So this is where promotores and promotoras are a good example of being able to spread the word. And one of the things that they also do is they connect them to resources. There was a huge air quality concern. And so with what we saw with a lot of the promotores and the street, even the street vendors that we work with is they were handing out masks. You know, there was masks that were being handed out everywhere. So they would just bring them and they would bring them to the community and just hand them out. So I think that that's a huge resource, for everybody who is just not able to get information online. They don't have the access. And many times they just need help just setting up an appointment online because they don't know how to do that. And so going back to some of the services we're providing, you know, we have the rental assistance program. We're also a housing counseling agency. I'm not sure if I mentioned it earlier, but we do a lot of foreclosure prevention. And part of our disaster relief support is helping those people that are have lost their homes during the fire. Because unfortunately, many of them still have mortgages. So they actually need to figure out what's going to happen and just get some guidance and support through FEMA applications and things like that. So a lot of the information that people need is not necessarily as accessible to them. So I think that's another way where people can learn about all the different services that are out there. So yeah, definitely, I think promotores is a good network. They get paid, you know, we definitely want to make sure that we're supporting their work. So most of the promotores that I know, are also undocumented. So they get, you know, paid on the stipends or different things like that. But there are some promotores that just do that as their job and they get paid. So definitely if you are ever considering doing a promotor, anybody out there that's listening to this wants to get a program with promotores going, make sure that you pay them because they, you know, they're doing out there, they're the feet on the ground. They're the ones that are, you know, getting the word out there to the community.
Absolutely. And so that kind of makes me think, like, that seems like an example of an existing structure that you know, organizers have built that has been adapted for various different purposes. And of course, you know, wildfires in Southern California, they happen due to a multitude of factors, but the risk factors include both worsening climate change and the hotter and drier weather that comes with it, as well as, you know, harmful land use patterns that are unfriendly to the local ecosystems. And I'm wondering, you know, in addition to some of these things that you've already built, has climate change or changing environmental factors had any kind of effect on the work that you're doing or required you to kind of change up things?
Yeah, I think one of the things that sometimes we don't consider is how intersectional the work is when we're working with individuals and how different things affect them. Climate, you know, how that affects health and how also that affects financially. So we do a lot of financial services and, when we sit down with, clients, you know, most of the time, again, like the immigrant population that we work with, because of climate change and because, you know, just talking about this past summer and the wave of heat that we got even in September, people just are not able to survive without, having air conditioning, right? So, one of the things that we saw is that because of the air conditioning use, their utility bills went up so high. They're doubled and tripled to the point where they weren't able to afford to pay it. So one of those things that we're doing is just figuring out how do we support, you know, those individuals and how can we connect with other advocates that are doing work around just climate change and just doing any advocacy that comes with supporting people as they're kind of just dealing with just things like a high electricity bill because it's really hot, right? And we don't really get a lot of rain in LA, and that's part of what happened with the wildfires, right? Like all of that is connected in how people are affected by what's going on and now dealing with the air quality and getting people the education about like, hey, you shouldn't be out there. You know, you should wear masks. And we work with a lot of outdoor workers, like the street vending community. So they, you know, have been telling us that they are also not able to do sales. They can't be out there. They weren't right when the fires were happening. They weren't able to be out there as much as they wanted to. So they have a reduced loss in income because of just lack of sales and people are not out there and they can't be out there themselves because of their health. So I think, you know, when we think about organizing and just talking to other advocates and how we can just do more intersectional work and just talk about how climate change affects, you know, our health as well as our finances too. And so we just all need to be talking maybe the same language and more intersectionally. So, I think that doesn't necessarily relate. You know, when we think about my work, I do a lot of economic and social justice and housing work. We don't really think about that, but I think it's really important, especially now. Another thing that we started doing in our work is just looking at our buildings. So we're an affordable housing developer. We have many buildings. We've been doing a lot of decarbonization to also help with utilities. So that's another thing that we're doing with our specific tenants is tapping into resources to decarbonize our buildings so that they are more energy efficient, as well as also helping the tenants with, lower utilities as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you just said, it's sort of it's this kind of omnifarious issue, right, with all these intersecting elements. Be that, you know, immigration status, be that where you work and how you work, your labor is indoors or outdoors. These are all things that are affected by climate change, to say nothing of the increasing frequency and severity of weather events and things like that. So I'm curious what you think about, I guess, what kinds of organizing or models of community action and community building you feel will be most necessary or effective in the face of these kind of increasing burdens.
Yeah, I think like I was saying with the intersections, is really talking to other organizations and other campaigns that are really, like, you know, dealing with other issues, and find out where that intersectionality is and how we can meet with them, you know, and just make sure that we are using the same language and saying, like, okay, this affects us. The promotores is another good, you know, way of, like, part of, like, it's similar to organizing, right? Is you build leadership within the community, educate them, and so that they are also, like, letting other people know, like, how this also is affecting them. It's not just, like, intangible thing that we don't know, like, what's going on, right? Like, or how, you know, it's real, especially now with the new, environment politically. Is like, you know, there's so many deregulation that we'll probably see happening around, like, just everything that has to do with supporting people that were doing work around climate change. So I feel like just education is key, and having, you know, more information out there and people knowing, hey, this is real, climate change is real. And you know, you can't just turn on the faucet and somewhere up in Northern California and all of a sudden we're going to have water in LA, right? Like, those, I don't know, I'm sure, I don't know if you've been hearing on the news, but what's supposed to fix our fire problems, right? So I think combating misinformation is going to be a huge kind of feat in the next 4 years, just really combating and that misinformation and getting as much education out there and more people involved.
Definitely. And so, kind of returning a little bit to some of the financial and solidarity economy work that you were talking about earlier, another element of ELAC's work that I'm interested in learning more about is the kind of cooperative lending economy, lending circles type of stuff that you all do. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I love to talk about lending circles. So we are a partner of what we call Lending Circles Partner in California. So Lending Circles have been around for many, many years, even before my time, many years before that. So my first experience with social lending and Lending Circles was growing up in Mexico. My mom was in her friends, they would get together, they would actually lend each other a pot of money, and they would each take turns on when they would need that money, right? So they would all pitch in and they would collect a certain amount of money, and then they will use it and then pay it back, right? Gradually. Sometimes it was weekly, monthly, however they decided on. And in Spanish, they're called tandas or cundinas. There are different words in other countries, as a lot of other countries also do this type of lending. And I remember that was, you know, a lady would knock on our door and my mom would be like, oh, tell her I'll pay her tomorrow or something like that, right? It was just an informal economy, right? Like, that's how lending circles worked. So one of the things that we're doing with our partners are called Mission Asset Fund. And they're based out of San Francisco, MAF for short. They have created a system to use the same type of informal social lending to actually formalize it in a way where people are doing the same thing, but they are getting actually credit for doing that. So it is directly being reported to the credit bureaus. So an example, we get at least 6 to 12 people We get them all together. They all decide on how much they're going to lend to each other monthly. Let's say it's 10 people. They want to lend $100 a month. That's $1,000. So each person takes a turn per month to keep that $1,000. And each person is paying it back, right? Each month, the other months that they don't have it. So the goal there is that sometimes people just need to have an emergency, or they maybe have a quinceañera, or like they had to pay back a debt that is coming back. Some people use a lot of promo, you know, credit cards where they tell you, oh, you have until this time and they will charge you an interest. So it really ranges on the different reasons why people use it. Sometimes we have street vendors use it because they need to buy equipment or they need to buy inventory for their business. So they use it for different things. And so one of the things that they do in what we call a formation is we get all this 10 people together and they talk to each other and then decide what months each one of them is getting the money. And they also decide on the amounts. So once they make that decision, we do a formation. They actually sign a promissory note. That's basically saying that we're going to be pulling their money from their bank account every month at the same time and the month that they're getting their money. And then that's getting reported as a loan through their credit bureaus. And the example I'm using is $1,000 a month. It will show up as a loan for $1,000 with a payment of $100 per month. And meanwhile, that's helping you, the individuals, build credit. Many of them don't have credit, or maybe they don't have good credit because that's why they need a loan, right? They can't get a loan or a credit card at a financial institution. So that is actually helping people with their credit. And our program is meant to support people with credit. So we don't charge any interest and we don't charge any fees to be part of the loan. So it's just a really cool way of like helping people understand finances. They do have to have a bank account. So many times we have to have conversations around what that means because many of them don't have a bank account. They also need an email. So we help them with that. So it's just a lot of them just getting into the financial aspect of what it means to have a loan and have credit. And then from there, we can have more conversations after they finish up the loan and what their credit looks like to see if they want to go more mainstream and look at the credit cards or look at other loans.
Well, yeah, when you describe these sort of, informal systems and, semi-formal cooperative systems that, people use to sort of lean on each other, it makes me think about this concept I don't love the word resiliency. I think a lot of capital C, capital P climate professionals like to talk about resilience and resilient communities in the face of climate change. And, in recent years, I think some of the environmental justice movement has started to sort of push back on that in the sense that, we're saying we don't want to have to be resilient to all these horrible things. And we just want the poor conditions to end. How about that? And so that sort of makes me think, I guess, like, what do you think that communities like East LA, like the one that you work in and belong to, like, what do you think that these communities need in a broad sense to thrive and not just kind of, get by?
Yeah. Oh, that's a loaded question. And yeah, I think I agree with you on the resilience part, like, because, I'll, in the work that I do, I was, we do a lot of financial coaching and we get a lot of people like banks that work at big banks that fund our work. And many times they'll say, oh, yeah, I mean, people just need to learn how to budget. They need financial literacy. Right. And it's like when we meet with individuals, it's like, no, they know their money. They understand when the money's coming in, what they need to buy. It's not a matter of financial literacy. Like, people have been, budgeting for a long time and they know how to use their money. It's about support. Like, when I talk about financial equity and support and access, like, many times, like, the people that are that I work with, they don't know that they can open an account at a bank or a credit union, for example, right? Because they're undocumented and they're afraid and they're not sure that they can walk in, and they're intimidated because maybe they had a bad experience at another bank or a bank in their country. So I think as, you know, when we talk about like just financial overall, it's just, you know, getting rid of all those, you know, predatory lending. There's so much predatory lending in our communities. There's a lot of check cashers that are charging, high percentages for just cashing a check, right? And then just having access to that, people that send money to their countries, they pay so much money to do that. So when I think about just what our community needs on that aspect is just, you know, safe financial products, you know, safe financial products that are not gouging them and charging them high interest, high fees for just being able to have access to their money and being able to send it to their loved ones in their country. And the other things I think about is just housing. You know, the living in LA is so expensive. So when you think about the east side of LA, many times, well, east side of LA was a redline community for a long time. And it's been a community minorities for a really long time. But because of our proximity to downtown, there's been a lot of gentrifying forces that want to come our way. And really, because of we're 2 miles, like you can literally walk. We have a really famous area in Boyle Heights that's called Mariachi Plaza. You can walk across the street in Mariachi Plaza, and you can see downtown on the horizon. So a lot of people that are wanting to be near downtown and wanting to move into, they can't afford downtown, so they're gonna gentrify Boyle Heights, the east side of LA, because they are seeing that that's cheaper for them to come to the neighborhood. So I think the community just needs more affordable housing, more rent control, tenants' rights, and really supportive ways for people to just have a safe place to live that's affordable for them. And then coming back to the environmental justice and really the work around what's happening with climate change is Boyle Heights for a long time was actually, they didn't have a say in what was going on. So if you look at a map of the east side of LA, there's 5 freeways that cross the neighborhood, just across the neighborhood. And it was because there was nobody speaking up, you know, when planners, urban planners, and when people were planning what the city was going to look like or where to put these freeways, there was nobody speaking up for them. Nobody saying like, hey, this is going to affect the community because of all these cars coming through, all of the smog, all of the different pollution that comes with having 5 freeways crossing your neighborhood. When you go to the park, that's what you're seeing, right? So you're seeing the freeways. So yeah, just investment in green space and just, anything that would help with helping them cool down and have areas for them to really walk around. Right behind me, my door's closed, my window's closed, but there's a cemetery, and it's one of the few green spaces in the community. And people walk around the cemetery, and that's where they found has been a place for them to be able to walk out and have like a space to be outdoors and just get a walk or a run, a workout throughout their day. So there's definitely needs to be an investment in more green spaces and that are safe for them. There was a lot of question, a lot more that I think that the East Side needs. But lastly, just thinking about the political environment, I'm very happy that the city of LA passed a sanctuary city. So we are a sanctuary city where I think it's just education needs to go out there to the people, to our community, a lot more of understanding what that means to be a sanctuary city. And there's a lot of community that's kind of building around protecting our undocumented neighbors and our families. So I think that they just, you know, what they would need to thrive is to not have to worry about being persecuted or, you know, being chased by immigration. So all of that and even more that I can't think of at the moment. But yeah, thank you for asking that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it sort of reminds me of, you know, what you were talking about just at the very top of the interview with all these domestic workers, right, who are made invisible by, you know, a lot of factors, and particularly in the reporting around the Palisades fire. And I really appreciate the window you've given us, you know, all too briefly, into that community and the perspective that you have on this and the work that you're doing. So Elba Serrano, Associate Vice President of East LA Community Corporation, ELAC. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having and listening for your thoughtful questions. I appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Elba Serrano, Associate Vice President at East Los Angeles Community Corporation. I want to sincerely thank Elba for taking some time out of her busy day to speak with me. You can learn more about ELAC and the work that they do at elacc.org. I know this interview was maybe a little bit different from what I've done so far here on The Rift. ELAC, of course, is not working directly on environmental or climate issues, and most of my conversation with Elba wasn't really about that. But as she said herself, all of these issues intersect. When an immigrant domestic worker is put out of work because of the damage caused by a wildfire, when a day laborer is breathing in particle matter and toxins caused by the fires as they work cleanup jobs, when East LA residents' energy bills go through the roof because of excessive heat, their struggles are layered across immigration status, economic insecurity, and the effects, of course, of climate change and environmental injustice. And I appreciated Elba emphasizing the necessity for all of us to be talking to each other and learning from each other across these different issues, so that we can find those points of connection, that shared language, and hopefully build stronger, more robust movements to take on the difficult future that lies ahead. That's today's show. As always, thank you so much for tuning into The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign's community radio station. You can listen to recordings of The Rift on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. The recording of this episode will be up later this evening. Up next, we've got some tunes for a little bit, and then at the top of the hour is On the Move with Herbert Burnett. I'll be back here for the next episode of The Rift 2 weeks from now on Sunday, February 16th. Take care.
hour of programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT, along with our community partners, including Furniture Lounge, The Upper Bout, Josh Gallagher at Edward Jones Financial, and A to Z Painting and Decorating. Listener-supported, volunteer-run since 1981. Community radio for East Central Illinois, 90.1 FM WEFT.